From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, President Obama says tougher sanctions are being teed up for Russia if Moscow continues to feed unrest in eastern Ukraine.
If, once again, Russia fails to abide by both the spirit and the letter of what was discussed in Geneva, that there will be further consequences and we will ramp up further sanctions.
Also today, why the death of net neutrality could favour big business but hurt the consumer. And the United Nations calls on warring factions in South Sudan to end the circle of violence.
What I've so far seen in the mosque and in other parts of town has really been very, very heart-wrenching. Certainly atrocities have been committed here on a very significant scale.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Israel has formally suspended peace talks with the Palestinians in light of the announced reconciliation of Hamas and Fatah. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas must abandon his pact with Hamas if he wants peace with Israel. On Wednesday, representatives for Hamas and Fatah say they aim to form an interim unity government in the coming weeks. But Israel, along with the U.S. and EU, say Hamas is a terrorist group. Russian President Vladimir Putin is mobilizing Russian forces on the Ukrainian border following Kiev's operation to disable pro-Moscow militants in the east of the country. Pro-Russian protesters have been refusing to leave administrative buildings they've been occupying in a dozen eastern Ukrainian towns. Two of the militants have been reported dead after Ukrainian forces moved to clear out protesters in the city of Slovyansk. Mr. Putin had previously warned of consequences for Ukraine if force was used against the activists. There are tens of thousands of Russian troops along the edge of Ukraine. Russian leaders say military exercises will be held in southern and western military districts, including Air Force troops training for maneuvers along the country's border. Last week, the two countries, as well as the U.S. and the EU, struck a deal in Geneva to de-escalate tensions, which stipulated that Moscow must try to halt the actions of the militant protesters. But the U.S. and the EU say Russia has not been holding up its end of the bargain. The EU is also in emergency talks to seek a deal with Slovakia to supply Ukraine with gas in the event that fuel taps from Russia are compromised due to ongoing tension. Our EU correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
The EU is brokering crisis talks with Ukraine and Russia this and next week to ward off a potential energy crisis in Europe, as Moscow doubles the price of gas to Ukraine, through which other European countries get their fuel. Energy Commissioner Günther Oettinger is seeking a deal with Slovakia to reroute gas from Russia back to Ukraine, a move Moscow says would be illegal.
The White House has condemned an attack in Kabul that killed three Americans working at a hospital in the Afghan capital. A policeman guarding the hospital turned his own gun on the staff, as our U.S. correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Despicable and cowardly, that's how the White House is describing the attack on a hospital in the Afghan capital treating infants and their mothers. One doctor from Chicago is reportedly among the dead. The hospital is run by a U.S. Christian charity. It says it provided treatment to the attacker, who shot himself after killing members of the hospital's team.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Washington's powerful Federal Communications Commission has proposed new rules for the internet that some say would allow wealthy corporations to dominate. As Alice Olstein reports, while web providers wouldn't be allowed to block content or intentionally slow down certain websites, they would be able to offer speedier service at a price.
The U.S. Federal Communications Commission unveiled controversial new rules Thursday that, if implemented, would fundamentally change the internet. They've proposed a pay-for-play model in which companies like Google or Netflix could pay web providers like Comcast and Verizon to have a fast lane on the internet. The move came after a federal court struck down the agency's rule that all online content must be treated equally. The commission will vote on the new rule on May 15th. Alice Olstein, Washington.
And the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has announced that it plans to impose the first federal regulations on electronic cigarettes, including banning sales to anyone under 18. The regulatory agency says it plans to propose rules for the makers of the devices, which turn nicotine-laced water into vapor. Here's Lorna Shattuck with the details.
The Food and Drug Administration has vowed for months to crack down on the sales and marketing practices of e-cigarette companies. Now it says sales of the popular devices, along with pipe tobacco and cigars, will be prohibited to Americans under 18. People buying them will also be required to show photo ID to prove their age, a measure already in place in several US states. But federal officials and advocates say it'll take at least another year for the rules to take effect, possibly longer if the companies affected sue to block them. Up until now, the e-cigarette market has been relatively unregulated, and these rules still fall short of those governing traditional cigarettes. The new laws won't ban advertisements or internet sales, but makers will be required to disclose the chemicals used in e-cigarettes and be banned from giving out free samples. Lorna Shattuck, Washington.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
We have already applied sanctions that have had an impact on the Russian economy, and we have continued to hold out the prospect, the possibility, to resolve this issue diplomatically. There was some possibility that Russia could take the wiser course after the meetings in Geneva. So far, at least, we have seen them not abide by the spirit or the letter of the agreement in Geneva.
Barack Obama interrupting his Asia tour to comment on the latest developments in Ukraine's standoff with Russia. The US president's remarks came as several pro-Russian militants were reportedly killed during clashes with Ukrainian security forces in the restive eastern region. Russian President Vladimir Putin responded to the violence, saying Kiev's actions could carry serious consequences. Mr. Putin delivered his warning as Russia's military launched tactical drills along the border with Ukraine. For more on these latest developments, I spoke to the Christian Science Monitor's Ukraine correspondent, Sabra Ayres.
The Ukrainian military started a new offense against these, what they're calling separatists, which are pro-Russia groups that have taken over several government and police stations in the eastern region of the Donetsk Oblast and in Luhansk. And the first operative, as you know, didn't get very far. You saw some Ukrainian soldiers actually giving up their weapons. On this round, apparently, there was a sort of a firefight in the town of Slavyansk. They also managed to regain control of a building down in the south of the oblast in Mariupol. So today's situation was a little bit different, although it wasn't entirely sort of a clean sweep. There are still separatists who are holding some of these buildings.
And those events were responded to by the Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier when he talked about there would be consequences for this violence. What can we read into that? Because there have been military drills by the Russian military along that border region today as well.
Yeah, this is certainly the fear, is that Russia will respond militarily. Obviously, they have a very, compared to Ukraine's military, they have a very strong military, so this wouldn't be good at all. And certainly the Ukrainians are worried about this. But the Kyiv government is maintaining that it has a right to carry out these anti-terrorist operations. Russia's responding, saying, these are Russian speakers, these are Russian people, we have an interest in defending them. So it's sort of we're still in a standoff. It's just that it seems to have, the tension seems to have ratcheted up a lot higher.
The U.S. President Barack Obama, he broke briefly from his tour in Asia to discuss the events in Ukraine, suggesting that perhaps there were tougher, deeper sanctions that could come Moscow's way if there's some form of retaliation to these events.
That's right. And, he's saying that they could happen within days as opposed to weeks. Sanctions, the Ukrainians are saying that the sanctions will help, although a lot of them would say that they'd like a different kind of help. Whether or not the West is considering that, they've said that they aren't ready to do that. But sanctions, could be something that would really, put the pressure on Putin to ease the tensions.
Journalist Sabra Ayres in Ukraine. The This is FSN Reports. The US Federal Communications Commission unveiled controversial new rules on Thursday that, if implemented, could fundamentally change the internet by allowing corporations to pay extra to deliver their content to consumers faster. The move followed a federal court ruling earlier this year that struck down the agency's holding that all online content must be treated equally. For more, our Washington correspondent Alice Olstein spoke with Amelia Deloney with the Center for Media Justice, who said the rule change could create a separate and unequal internet.
You know, we turn to the internet for everything, for job searches, for educational attainment, secondary degrees, or even the homework you need to do in high school requires an internet connection. We go to the internet for shopping. We go to the internet for healthcare. We go to the internet for all of these critical issues in our lives. You know, if a pay-to-play system was put in place, you know, you would have internet service providers who could essentially wheel and deal and create the fast lanes for their content. So, for example, instead of being able to log onto the internet and, you know, use a service provider to upload your music if you're a music producer, or to upload items on, you know, an internet site that you sold because that was your living, or to access different healthcare sites, you would have a slower connection. Your connection would not be as quality, it would not be as fast, it would not be as good, because different companies had been in the background making agreements saying, you're going to deliver my content first, you're going to deliver my content faster.
So these rules wouldn't go as far as some of the corporations want. They wanted to be able to entirely block websites that they don't like. But this new rule also is somewhat of a departure from the agency's previous statements and priorities?
Exactly. I mean, that's what it seems like right now. And, you know, there's more to be determined. I think, you know, the real issue is that for years now, hundreds of thousands of people, in fact, millions of people across the country, in town halls, in op-eds, in letters to the FCC, in comments that were filed, in, you know, editorial debates in newspapers, have said time and again what they want is an internet that's open, they want an internet that's affordable, and they want an internet that's free from discrimination. So it's very clear what the people want, and our disappointment or concern is really that the FCC is not listening to what the people want, and that should inform what's in the public's best interest, not what the corporations are saying.
And some have pointed to the new FCC chairman's previous work for the industry that could benefit from this proposal. Can you explain that?
Well, I think that there's always a concern about the revolving door in Washington and where people come from and where people go to. I think that the important piece from our perspective is that we really need a regulator, and we need a chairman that is committed to listening to the people, and we hope that that is what he follows.
So what happens next? Will there be a public comment period for these rules? What's the process?
So as I understand it, you know, the notice for proposal, well, let me back up and say, I understand that there will be a press conference today where more information will be disclosed. Following that, this order will move for a vote at the May 15th open meeting. And then based on the vote, you know, it would be open for comment. So there's still, you know, this is a fight that will continue over the summer. This isn't something that's going to happen overnight. And so I think it's really important for people across the country to know what's at stake, because now is the time to raise your voice. I mean, people have been doing this all along, but now more than ever, people need to really weigh in and say what is being proposed is absolutely unacceptable. This is not what has been asked for. People want an open internet. They want net neutrality. They want an internet that's free from discrimination.
FSN's Alice Olstein talking to Amalia Deloney with the Center for Media Justice. Now, the United Nations has called on the warring factions in South Sudan to end what it's described as the circle of violence. The recent massacre of 200 civilians has been called a game changer by the UN's top humanitarian official and an abomination by the White House. An attempted coup in December sparked a conflict that bears worrying similarities to the genocide in Rwanda 20 years ago. FSN's United Nations correspondent Nick Harper reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
Bentoui's roads are lined with bodies. So many, in fact, the jaws of a bulldozer is used to shovel them up. These are men, women, and children killed for being ethnically different. Many of the 200 civilians were executed as they tried to seek shelter in a hospital and a church. Nearby, in front of a mosque, dogs and pigs root around the corpses. These are deeply disturbing scenes from a hate-filled conflict. The UN's Toby Lanza surveys the area. He does so wearing body armour, a reminder that the violence may have passed, but it's not far away.
During the past few days, Bentiu was the scene of severe violence, very targeted, deliberate violence that struck individuals of certain identities. And I think that what I've so far seen in the mosque and in other parts of town has really been very, very heart-wrenching. Certainly atrocities have been committed here on a very significant scale.
The Dinka population of the town were targeted by the rebel soldiers of Nuer ethnicity. Reports say they were hunted down and killed by rebel forces, who were urged on by broadcasts on the town's radio station, just as the airways were used to promote killings in Rwanda 20 years ago. The Nuers even killed their own people, separating out those who weren't applauding and cheering the actions of the rebel fighters. The massacre in Bentiu follows an attack last week on the UN compound in Bour, where civilians were sheltering. 50 people died in the battle as peacekeepers tried to keep armed youth from entering the camp. Briefing the UN Security Council in New York on Wednesday afternoon, the UN's head of peacekeeping operations, Hervé Latsous, said this attack denoted a serious escalation in the conflict.
This cycle of violence that started on the 15th of December last year has to stop. It must stop immediately. Yet, we see that neither party is ready to in any way cease the hostilities.
The current president of the Security Council, Joe Ogwu, said the possibility of sanctions against leading figures in South Sudan had been discussed.
Most of us suggested using the principle of deterrence to send a message unequivocally to the parties responsible for this impunity that it must not happen again.
But the worry is it will. Several hundred UN peacekeepers are currently trying to protect more than 22,000 civilians who've taken refuge inside the walls of the UN compound in Bentiu. Here's UN spokesman Stefan Dzidzarek.
They are doing their utmost to protect the civilians that have sought shelter. But it is always good to remind the government of South Sudan of their primary responsibility in protecting UN premises and in ensuring the protection of their own civilians.
This month, the world has marked the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. South Sudan has marked it by showing the world its own horrors of ethnic warfare. Nick Harper, New York.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, our new segment taking an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, the debate over Islamic extremism. Is it still the primary threat facing the developed world? That's the view of former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He said in London on Wednesday that world powers should put aside their differences over Ukraine and Syria and concentrate instead on the battle against Al-Qaeda and its affiliated proxies. Mr. Blair told Britain's Sky News the security of the developed world is at stake.
All over the region right now, in the Middle East and beyond it, we are facing essentially one fight, one struggle, that is between those who want modern tolerant societies and modern open economies and those who want to run society and economy according to a religious stroke political ideology that is backward looking and reactionary. And what I'm saying is, in this struggle that's going on all over the region and beyond at the moment, it's important we take sides, that we're on the side of the open-minded and tolerant people, and that we're prepared to make the commitment and engagement necessary to have that policy work.
So is he right? In Britain and elsewhere, Tony Blair is best remembered as the leader who steadfastly supported former US President George W. Bush over his decision to invade Iraq and Afghanistan in the aftermath of the Al-Qaeda attacks of September the 11th, 2001. Ian Black is the Middle East editor of Britain's Guardian newspaper, and he told Julia Hartley Brewer of Britain's LBC radio that he thinks Mr. Blair's got it all wrong.
Gosh, if you look at the storm of reactions to his speech, you can certainly conclude that a lot of people do not think that he's right. I think the issue here is that there's something to talk about, the rise of Islamic extremism. Even Blair's critics don't dispute that, but a lot of people, many people, question whether he's the right person to deliver the message. I think Blair's own record, particularly focusing on the war in Iraq, a lot of other people look at his role as the Middle East peace envoy, a lot of people believe that he is simply the last person to talk about an issue where many critics say he has been responsible for creating a big part of the problem, particularly the war in Iraq. Is there a problem of Islamic extremism? There certainly is. Is that the right way of going about it, or should you look at problems in individual countries, political systems, democracy, poverty, all kinds of other issues that are better tackled on a case-by-case basis? I think it's the tone of the message, the sweeping generalizations, and that big question about whether Tony Blair is the right man to raise this issue, that I think goes to the main points that people are objecting to.
Well, indeed, I mean, you said should we look at other issues, new issues of poverty and the like. And he does make the point in the speech, in reference to Saudi Arabia, that, you know, he says it's absurd to spend billions of dollars on security arrangements and on defence to protect ourselves against the consequences of an ideology that is being advocated in the formal and informal school systems and in civic institutions of the very countries with whom we have intimate security and defence relationships. What he's saying is that children are being indoctrinated in Islamic extremism in countries like Saudi Arabia, and there's nothing we can do about it.
I'm not sure that people who know the Middle East would agree that Islamic extremism is the problem of Saudi Arabia or indeed of other countries. One of the most striking features of Blair's speech is the very strong endorsement he gives, for example, but an important example, to what's happened in Egypt. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an Islamist political organization, won democratic elections in Egypt. And last year, they were removed from power by the Egyptian military. Now, whether you like the Muslim Brotherhood or not, whether you're an Egyptian or not an Egyptian, the argument about democratic elections and the role of the military is a clear one. Blair is coming down very very clearly on one side of that argument. If you worry about Islamic extremism, people will say, then is it a good idea that when Islamists win elections, they're then removed from power by people who don't like them? If you want to encourage democracy and pluralism, is that the right way to go about it? Now, Blair is coming down very, very clearly on the side of a military intervention to remove a democratically elected government. It's true that it was a very unpopular government, but
it was also a government. I mean, I'm not defending either side, but it was also a government that was basically rounding up and imprisoning and torturing anybody who was who opposed them, which is not really what democratically elected governments are supposed to do.
It's a big overstatement of what was happening. It was largely a question of incompetence. That's certainly true, but the principle remains. Here is the former prime minister of a Western democratic country coming out and openly endorsing the overthrow by the military of a democratically elected government. There's no way around that. And people go back to look at other things that Blair has done in the Middle East. We've discussed his role in Iraq and his conspicuous failure to achieve anything much at all in his role over several years now as the envoy to the Middle East peace process. It's also a striking omission in his speech. Certainly many Arabs and others who've commented on it note that he's talking about Israel and Palestine, which is probably the best known issue, political issue in the Middle East today. But he says nothing about the central issues of that conflict, reinforcing for many people the sense that he has been biased to one side, and that's contributed to his failure to achieve anything at all. So there's a lot of questions about his credentials to make this speech.
And as you say, the generalisations, but I suppose his key message, and it's been something that he has put, I remember, in his evidence to the Chilcot inquiry. We still haven't seen the results of that inquiry into what happened in the run-up to the decision to go to war in Iraq. But his issue has always been, from what I can gather from his public statements, is that, you know, intervention
is often the best thing to do. And the failure to intervene, he continues to argue many years on, is actually a bigger cause of problems. A failure to intervene in Iraq, he has always argued, and argued at Chilcot, would have led to more Iraqis dying. He's argued that a failure to act on Syria, I mean, 3 years on, we've got estimates 150,000 killed, violence against civilians. But we also know, you know, millions displaced and maybe will die as a result of health issues, as a result of that. I mean, there are lots of other issues, aren't there, in which case, is he right in terms of saying that the world leaders now need to engage and can't just put their heads in the sand, which you could argue, and certainly when we look at issues like Ukraine and dealing with Putin over Ukraine and Crimea, that the people like President Obama and indeed David Cameron and Hollande and Angela Merkel and Germany, that they actually are just sort of putting their heads down and just hoping it all goes away. And actually they are showing weakness in the face, in this case of Putin, but also weakness in the face of Islamic extremism, which needs to be met head on.
Well, you know, I think you raise a very important question about Syria. Syria is an ongoing and appalling tragedy, where, as you say, 150,000 people have already been killed in just over 3 years. Now, we know, we saw it in the Parliament here in Westminster, there was a resounding opposition in Britain to intervention in Syria. You can have your view on the rights and wrongs of that vote, but what you can't do, I think, is to ignore the very, very big role played by people's opposition to what happened in Iraq. And you can make an argument that the need to intervene, if there is such a need in whatever the circumstances, that has been undermined enormously by what happened in Iraq. So many people have referred to the long-awaited Chilcot report to find out exactly what happened. Now, for Blair to talk about Syria is fine, but he can't then ignore the very, very long shadow of Iraq. And you also can't ignore the very important argument, I think, that the American-British intervention in Iraq almost certainly did more than anything else to encourage Islamic extremism and terrorism, which sadly we're still seeing so much of.
Do you think, I mean, time is against us, we'll have to close soon, but do you think that actually it is actions by the West, by Britain and by America, although remember in, say, Afghanistan, many other countries were also involved, that has actually been the recruiting sergeant for Islamic extremism, and therefore inaction can actually be the best policy?
I think that it's impossible to have this discussion without looking at the role of the West. It's also impossible to have it without looking at the flaws in the societies in question, which is why when you have an important country like Egypt, which went through, everybody remembers the extraordinary drama and turmoil of all those hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating in Tahrir Square. When you have a drama like that, when you have people, you know, taking their fate into their hands, and it ends in another military takeover, endorsed effectively by many Western governments and very explicitly by Blair, you have to look at the role of the West in this story as well, and you can't just have a narrative of overarching Islamic extremism and say that that's the problem. It is a problem, but it's only part of a wider issue.
That's Ian Black of The Guardian talking to Julia Hartley Brewer on Britain's LBC Radio. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Friday, it's a product worth billions of dollars, but is it safe? We investigate the rapid growth of the e-cigarette and the uncertainty surrounding the impact on your health.
Some have characterized it, frankly, as the wild, wild west. And certainly we feel that at the present time it is let the buyer beware.
That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.